Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is pushing back against that tide. They make high-quality clothing for a summer wardrobe you'll love, all made right here in the USA. Support America's workers and get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code STAPLE20.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the major stories making the news here in Ireland and around the world in business and in politics. Coming up on today's show, if you're contemplating a last minute Spanish holiday, well, stay tuned because over-tourism and tourism degrowth is a real thing in Spain at the moment. And Sam Jones of The Guardian will be here to tell us all about it. In Techscape, we'll be looking at how big tech companies are ditching the beanbags and the latte machines for tougher lines with their staff. And finally, Ursula von der Leyen made it across the line with ease in the end to become the president of the European Commission for a second time. Jack Power of the Irish Times, he's the European correspondent there, and he's going to join us to tell us all about how it panned out and what it means for Ireland. You can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. And now it's time for this.
Techscape on Taking Stock. Brought to you by PwC. Our industry experts can help you unlock the full potential of AI to transform your business safely and responsibly. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
Now, it was a world of climbing walls and beanbags. The early years of the big, large tech giants offered employees the chance to bring their whole selves to work. Questioning what they were asked to do was seen as a normal practice, and the traditional workplace and the hierarchies that they had and the traditional management structures that we were all used to were frowned upon. But now things have changed. To understand why managers are reasserting their roles, I'm delighted to be joined now by Elaine Moore. She is the tech comment editor at the Financial Times, and she wrote a piece outlining the new order in tech. Elaine, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Now, just remind us, Elaine, when all these big tech companies came in, like Facebook, and now they're known as Meta and Twitter, what were the early days like? What were they offering staff that we hadn't been used to before?
I think it was a completely radically new idea of what a workplace could be. And quite a lot of it was based around the idea that your workplace, your office could be a fun place, could be somewhere that you bring your whole self. That was one of the little mottos that was used at the time. But this idea that you don't just clock in a suit and clock out again and, you know, have your sort of corporate persona. This is the idea that what you're doing, you believe in wholeheartedly, and the company is trying to get the best out of you. So free food, free snacks, equipment, exercises, bikes you could ride around the campus. It was like a sort of blurring of your personal life and your office life. And that was all designed to try and attract the very best people to come and work in tech, because the period of time we're talking about, tech was still a relatively new sector, or certainly companies like Facebook were new companies. So if they wanted to compete against really well-paid, solid jobs in other sectors, they had to offer something new. And one of those new things was this idea that work would be a really interesting, fun place. Lots of other young people, lots of cool things going on. Your laundry would get done for you. You could sit and eat as much as you would like. And just the only thing that was asked of you is that you would produce incredible work.
Yeah. And it was promoted as this space that would foster creativity and make you feel relaxed. I remember I was working for a university at the time when we were brought down to one of these spaces in Dublin, because, as you know, like, a lot of those are HQ'd here in Dublin. And we had a few of the lecturers and professors from the university kind of walking around looking at people playing pool and, you know, having safe spaces and quiet spaces. They were dumbfounded. But I've worked on more than my fair share of election campaigns. And what it reminded me a great deal of was in an election campaign, you make the environment as conducive to people staying in the building as you possibly can, because you want them to work as long as they possibly can and stay there. So you provide food, relaxing areas, and you do everything you can to keep them in the building. And it did remind me a bit of that. So yeah, there might have been that other side of, like, getting people in, yes, fostering creativity, but keeping them there.
Absolutely. Silicon Valley, I don't know if you've been, but as a place, it's not very exciting. It's lots of big freeways. It's pretty flat. It's nothing really to look at. It's not a sort of very exciting town to be working in. So the companies had to make their campuses as interesting as possible. And yes, you're right. If you can provide food, if you can do someone's laundry, if you can get them to exercise on site, then they have no incentive to leave again. So you extract a lot more of their time, and they'll give it to you willingly, and they'll feel happy to do it. And that means that your company can explode, as a lot of these big tech companies did. So it asked a lot of employees for the relatively sort of cheap price of some food and some climbing equipment.
Yeah, it was a handy tactic for them that worked. I recall somebody saying once it was like the Hotel California. You could check out, but you just couldn't leave.
I think that's true. I also think we have a debt to them as well, because I do think that it raised the expectations
that's
of workers
true.
And other sectors of what you should expect your workplace to be. Things like open plan offices that are quite annoying for a lot of workers. They are still in place, but in terms of what the environment should look like, whether you should be able to have more freedom to express yourself, whether you should be expect your workplace to be somewhere that's welcoming, that's engaging, not just somewhere that you're a sort of corporate drone. I think we all have benefited to a degree from what tech companies have provided.
You're 100% right. That plus COVID, and then a realization that staff were actually, you know, the core of every organization and the key to keeping business going. They definitely, definitely both helped to lift the standards. But anyway, we can call it whatever we will. We can talk about what it produced, but you feel it's kind of changing now.
I do. And I think what's happening is that the tech sector is enormous now, so they don't need to fight so hard to bring in the best workers. If you are, you know that a big tech company is going to be somewhere that you're going to be very well paid. There's going to be traditional levels of management. It's not quite the same as joining a scrappy startup where you would expect to be given more privileged treatment. What's also happening is there is a degree of a power shift going on between workers and managers. And I think that's probably a post-COVID thing. Companies have been getting rid of a lot of workers. There's been a pull to bring people back to the office. There's been a push on tech companies to become more profitable, and a lot of them have, and so they want more from their workers. But there's also this sort of cultural change that's happening where a lot of the companies are pushing back on workers who feel that it's their place to criticize what the company does in public. In earlier days, companies would have been more willing to listen to that. And now what you're seeing is much more hard lines being drawn, workers being told, if you don't like what we do, you can just go somewhere else.
And why do you feel, Elaine, that employers feel a bit more emboldened in that relationship than they did a year or so ago?
I think that the job cuts have got a lot to do with it. They're across Silicon Valley, across the whole tech sector, companies employed a lot of people in the pandemic, and then they really drew back afterwards. We saw these thousands of jobs being cut at the exact same time. So that meant that the power was more in their hands. They felt like they were able to dictate the terms of employment a lot more. And then I also think that companies learn from one another. So one employer does it, the others learn from it. You see what's acceptable. And I do think that what Elon Musk did when he took over at Twitter was very widely watched. He got rid of a lot of workers. He had this view that you should be able to run companies with a very small number of employees, and you don't need to be providing all of these extras. Twitter was known as a pretty great place to work. There was a lot of freebies, and there was a lot of talk of expressing yourself and bringing your whole self to work. When Elon Musk bought it, took it over, he scrapped as much of that as he could, and he said, we should be focusing on the product, on the company. Now, that it's debatable how well that's gone. It hasn't gone very well. But the philosophy behind it, his ideas behind it, people in tech very watch what Elon Musk does very, very carefully. And he's held in very high regard by a lot of very senior people. And I do think that that might have had something to do with it as well.
That's a really interesting point. We saw this week again, he's firing more content moderators. The platform is plummeting in terms of advertising and subscribers. But yeah, I mean, a lot of people would disparage his work management style. And yet, as you say, he's still somebody that the industry as a whole probably does look to and look up to. You were in this article, which is really good. We highly recommend a read of it because it does give a sense of how things are shifting again. You talk about Netflix and maybe how their culture is changing.
Yes, and Netflix has this very famous memo that it puts out every so often that describes the culture of the company. It's very long. The first one was a big, long PowerPoint presentation. And it's quite bombastic, and it talks a lot about the qualities that it wants to see in its workers. The very first one was produced by the founder and the CEO, Reed Hastings, and it talked to us about honesty, candor, courage. If you were an employee, you would read that and think that you were being asked to criticize, the question, to be frank and direct. And that is something that Netflix is known for. What has changed is in the very latest one that came out a couple of weeks ago, there are some shifts in the language. Netflix has, by the way, already said, if you have a problem with our content, you don't need to work at Netflix, because it did get some backlash in some programs that put out a couple of years ago. And it's now talking about, the latest memo has this line that says not all opinions are equal. And the idea is that perhaps not everybody needs to be consulted on every decision that this company is taking. And I think that is a marker of a change that's happening across the sector. And I also wonder if maybe it's got something to do with changes in politics in America as well. In much, Silicon Valley was always known for being a fairly uniform Democrat voting part of the world. And I think that along with the rest of America, maybe the rest of the world, there's been more of a split, and perhaps that has also changed the relationship. A lot of companies are now suggesting that the workplace is not somewhere to bring your politics, your opinions, to have fights about culture. So I think that might have something to do with it as well.
Do you think that because America is more divided, that they want that to stay out of the workplace? Or do you think that there's a fear of the potential of a Donald Trump returning to the White House, that civil divide might escalate?
Maybe both. Mm. I think we won't know until we have the next elections. But I think that, and by the way, it's not just America. A lot of countries are following in America's footsteps. But I think that the passions that that come from politics right now can cause big ructions. Mm. And companies don't want that, in that they see that as being distracting from the work that should be done. And so what they're asking is that to be squashed. They just don't want people to have those kinds of conversations in the workplace. My guess would be we will see a lot more companies in different countries saying these sorts of things. In the US, they're now quite explicit. Google, for example, is explicit about this. And I would guess we'll see a lot more companies doing the same thing in other countries.
Yeah, and we're seeing a lot of those companies pushing back a lot more, not just in the workplace, but when there's protests in the workplace about specific issues.
Exactly. Google fired some people that it said were disrupting work that sit in a few years ago. And I think that in the past, maybe there would have been more of a dialogue between workers and management. And now there is a view that these sorts of events have to be shut down as quickly as possible. And you have to dissuade people from doing it again in the future. There's been a sort of move towards unionization in some companies and some sectors. And I think that also perhaps is creating more friction between workers, or perceived friction between workers and management, that maybe they feel like they have to act more decisively or more harshly towards workers who criticise the companies.
Right, yeah, that's a very interesting point. Yeah, the workers are obviously, you know, a very important part of this discussion. We talked earlier about COVID and a hiring and maybe an excessive hiring in tech companies for obvious reasons at that time, and now a rationalisation that happened afterwards to try and get them back to the right numbers. How are workers to behave in this situation? So if you're in a tech company now and you're used to an environment which is culturally open and, you know, prompting you to be creative and to voice your opinion, and suddenly that culture changes, but you feel a little bit like, you know, my job might be on the line, and is there some place for me to go? What do you do? Or is there any advice you can give?
I'm not sure there's any advice I can give, other than to say that the tech sector is very broad, and there will always be new startups where you could swap your perhaps more rigid corporate structure for something that is more open and that requires more input from the people that work there. So that's one option as well. But maybe also it's just recognizing that the tech sector now is not what it was 10 or 15 years ago. These are now big established multinational companies. If you work for one, you are entering into a corporation, into a hierarchical traditional setup. And that if you take that choice, then that will come with the restrictions that come with a lot of other large international corporations.
Indeed. So the concept of moving fast and break things is over, and now we're just going to conform to a corporate structure like everyone else.
I mean, they would disagree, but maybe.
Well, yeah, it kind of is beginning to look a bit like that, though. Elaine, thanks very much for being with us today. I found that very interesting. That was Elaine Moore, the tech comment editor of FT.com. Elaine, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. After the break, we look at the growing problem of overtourism. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Andy Johnson. Now take a quick listen to this. Why on earth are we playing Don't You Want Me Baby by the Human League, I hear you ask. Well, Spain winning the Euros might be tempting you into considering a Spanish holidays, but the locals, it seems, don't want us there anymore. From Ibiza to Barcelona, they're beginning to question whether the constant flow of inward tourism is actually doing more harm than good. I'm delighted to be joined now by Sam Jones, who's been writing about all of this for The Guardian. Sam, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Now, Sam, sometimes we forget just how big the tourism industry is in a country like Spain. Give us some overview of how much of the economy it actually accounts for.
Yeah, well, tourism activity accounts for roughly 12% of GDP in Spain as a whole. If you look at some particular areas, you get places like the Balearic Islands, Ibiza and Formentera, where it accounts for up to 84%. So it is a massive part of the economy and almost the totality of the economy in some regions.
Absolutely. Now, you've been writing about this a lot of late, and you're talking about over-tourism and degrowth of tourism. So maybe just talk to us about what over-tourism actually means.
Okay, well, I mean, I think we have to look back probably about 60-odd years for this. So in the early 60s, Spain opens up to the world, opens up for tourism. It wants to get the foreign money into the economy. By the 70s, you know, Spain is acquiring that reputation, which only continues to grow in the 80s and 90s of, you know, sol y playa, of sun and beaches and, you know, fun, slightly hedonistic. And we see, you know, lots of small fishing ports getting swallowed up, becoming big resorts. And that's the dominant model for kind of decades. And that goes on. But about 10 years ago, we see things shifting. People aren't staying in hotels and resorts so much anymore because of tourist rental flats, you know, on platforms such as Airbnb. They're staying and moving into city centres. And this is changing the balance of things. And this gives rise to this phrase, sobre turismo, over tourism, where people feel that their daily life is being compromised. The quality of their daily life is being compromised by the sheer number of tourists who are in sort of urban areas, you know, distorting the society, as the activists would say.
Yeah, and it's sort of like a case of be careful what you wish for, because they're extremely successful at attracting more and more people there. But as you say, it has a knock-on effect for the daily lives of the people who are living there. Also has longer-term consequences for things like accommodation and ordinary people going about trying to source living or rental accommodation. Maybe talk us through the implications of all that for Spain at the minute.
Yeah, of course it is. I mean, probably, you know, the case in point is Barcelona, which has obviously been in the news a lot lately because of the water pistol protests we saw a couple of weeks ago. You know, lots of people feel they're being priced out of affordable accommodation because a lot of people are snapping up flats that would once have been occupied by families, local families, and, you know, putting them on these platforms, renting them out, you know, to make money. You know, that's the way the market works. But lots of people say that's not fair. You know, people who are born in a city can't afford to stay in that city. It's hard for them to start a family and find a place that's big enough and that, most importantly, is affordable enough, you know, for them to stay in. And, you know, there's other sort of extreme examples. When I was in reporting in Ibiza about all this back in April, you know, I came across kind of seasonal workers who who didn't want to live kind of 10 to a flat. So we're living in vans and caravans and some in tents.
Mm.
And it's not just the seasonal workers who come over, you know, during the boom months of summer to work. Yeah, I spoke to a Guardia Civil officer, a Spanish police officer, who said that last summer, some of his colleagues were sleeping in vans and caravans, and that it's very difficult to get officers from the mainland to accept postings in Ibiza because of the high cost of living and of renting. And clearly that's going to have knock-on consequences for the police's ability to do their job if they don't have enough officers. So it's got, you know, these very wide-reaching social effects that maybe we don't think about all the time.
Mm. And they say that they're not protesting against individual people, but it's about the tourism industry. And then one of those groups you wrote about has a manifesto for degrowth. What does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to stress that people are not saying don't come.
Mm.
You know, we've had enough. It's very much kind of love the sinner, hate the sin, to put it that way. Spain knows how reliant it is on tourism, but it's calling for a pause and a rethink. So in places like the Canaries, they're saying, you know, we can't be, it's madness to be building more developments because that will only encourage more people and things are at breaking point anyway. You know, there are water shortages there. Daily life is becoming very difficult. And so in some places, they're called for a moratorium on any more sort of tourist developments, on any increase in tourist numbers. In places like Ibiza, they're calling for quotas, caps to be put on the number of cars that roll off the ferries and clog up the streets of the island in the summer. You know, that's got a knock-on effect for pollution. So it's basically people saying, you know, this model worked for decades, but it's shifted. It's not what it was. So we need to think best about how we can sort of deal with this together so people's daily lives aren't affected as badly as they're being at the moment.
Mm. And, you know, when you talk about this, it's not just a Spain unique problem. It's happening in lots of places. I mean, we all saw what happened in Venice and the new charges that have come in there. But ultimately, it does come down to the amount of people who are coming in versus the public services that they have to service those people and the visitors there. So it's really the public services under pressure. And then is it not a question of bad planning rather than over tourism?
Well, I think that sort of sort of punctual activity, the stress on public services, most of the time, because most visitors will not be making appointments with the GP. They won't be going to the local health centre. They might go to a local clinic if they've got an upset stomach or something like that. But yeah, that in terms of resources, water, yeah, that's a worry in places like the Canaries that are very dry, where, you know, people are worried about whether they can water their plants and then there's golf courses getting watered or swimming pools being filled. But yeah, it has been a question of planning. You know, so I think there's been a move to rethink the model over the past 2 to 3 decades. But I think that's been a bit interrupted by a large number of people coming to holiday in Spain in the 90s who would once have gone to the former Yugoslavia before the war began there. And then in recent years, the instability in many sort of favourite holiday destinations around the sort of near Middle East, that's stopped because of worries about security. So lots of those people came to Spain. So Spain could sort of afford to sit back and people would come whatever the cost. So I think that push to rethink things has sort of slowed down a bit and until now. And we are seeing more and more protests, which are overwhelmingly peaceful, bar some people getting squirted with water in Barcelona. But it does feel like we're at a bit of a turning point now.
And that's what I was just about to ask you, is like that feeling. So if you're a tourist going into some place like Barcelona for a weekend break or down to Ibiza for the week holiday, is there a growing sense of, you know, unwelcomeness, if that's even a word, but is that manifesting itself to people who are actually going on their holidays there now?
No, I don't think so. I've not heard or seen anything that would suggest that's the case. If people behave like good guests in the country, and don't go mad, I think the Spanish people are very, very pleased to have them as guests, as they have, you know, for the past kind of 6 decades. I think the Barcelona water pistol thing, it's very visual, it's very grab. It was a very good stunt in that sense. Not nice for the people who were squirted while they were trying to sit and have lunch or a beer or whatever. But it was a way of seizing the imagination. And you can see the way it's been, I can't speak about the Irish press, but the way it's been reported in the British press, that particular protest had quite a big impact
Yeah, no, same here. It did definitely resonate and called people to kind of question it. You mentioned a few moments ago Airbnb, that certainly has been a game changer in the tourism industry all over the world, and the use of the platforms and the ease of access certainly had a huge effect here in Ireland, and we're still grappling with how to regulate and deal with it through the revenue commissioners and all of that. But you mentioned in some of your articles this idea of illegal tourism. Maybe talk to me about the differential between that illegal tourism and how what they're doing, if anything, to deal with it.
Okay, so as you say, you know, past few years with these online platforms where you can book a holiday apartment, holiday flat. Obviously, one thinks of companies such as Airbnb. In Barcelona, you need a license from the local council to operate one of those. You need a registration number, and you need to book people in. So it's all very formal and regulated. That said, there are people who are advertising that don't have the correct licenses to doing that. So what they're doing is illegal.
According
to Barcelona City Council, they investigate about 300 reports of illegal flatlets a month, and which gives you scale up over the course of a year in a city of however many people Barcelona is, and that gives you, you know, an idea. I think it's about 1.6 million people live in Barcelona, so that's, you know, it's quite a few.
Yeah, and just looking at those figures for Barcelona, home to 1.6 million people, but 26 million overnight visitors in 2023. That's extraordinary, you know, by any measure, to try and deal with. And then you're talking about also those big, huge cruise ships that are coming in just for day trips.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the numbers, so yeah, Barcelona population 1.6 million last year, 15.6 million tourists. You look at Spain population 47 million as a country. Last year, 85.1 million international visitors. That's up almost 20% on the year before. And maybe it's starkest in Ibiza and the small neighbouring island of Formentera, whose population is 160,000. Last year, 3.7 million tourists.
Extraordinary, yeah.
And they're head-spinning figures.
Well, actually, some of the celebrations that we saw after the victory in the European Cup final there, they probably just make people want to go there more, because some of the scenes were extraordinary. You were writing about it as well.
I was, yeah. I was down in the centre of Madrid on Sunday night to watch the match on a big screen, and it was a great atmosphere. And everyone was behaving impeccably and just getting into the sport, getting behind the national team, and you know, coming back home on the metro afterwards, all calm, all smiles. All nice behaviour. And so, yeah, I think the message is that, you know, it is still a very welcoming country. You know, it's one of the most welcoming countries I've been to or lived in.
Well, I hate to bring up the bad news in this, but I'm detecting by your accent you might be an English fan. How did you feel after the match?
I'm a mix of things. So I was absolutely fine with the result. I've lived in Spain for 8 years. You know, my boys were supporting Spain, so. It was an uncontroversial result,
okay,
as far as I'm concerned.
Sam, listen, before I let you go, look, where do you see this going? Do you think it's going to escalate in terms of the protests, or do you think that they are protesting against the authorities rather than tourism? They've made their point, or do you see it kind of continuing now?
No, I think it's going to continue. You know, the protests are becoming more sort of closely spaced, but they've been happening since about 2016, 2017. And as you say, it feels like it's a protest against the model and the way the authorities have reacted. So it's just watching. I think there will be more. But the other thing to keep an eye on is that, you know, Barcelona's mayor has kind of sat up and taken notice of this, as his predecessor did, a bit, to be fair to her, and has said, you know, by 2029, we're going to get rid of these tourist flats. You know, the 10,000 tourist licenses that have been granted won't be renewed. And he said, you know, that housing is going to go back to the people of Barcelona. And he's also said that when there's a new housing development in Barcelona, 30% of that has to be social housing. So we are seeing responses now, and we're seeing, you know, similar music from the Canaries and from the Balearics of people saying, yeah, we get it. The authorities are getting it. They're listening to the voters. You know, they like the tourists, but they have to listen to the voters. at the end of the day. So the thing now is just to keep an eye on Barcelona for the next few years, because the mayor has said where Barcelona is leading, he expects other cities and other cities around the world to follow.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point that you make in your article as well about housing. And it's this migration all over Europe and people fleeing from one area to the other. That gentleman you spoke of living in his car, Mohammed, in your article also was talking about he doesn't feel bad about it because he's come from a worse place. So everything's relative, really.
It is, yeah. If you've grown up in a refugee camp because your family were forced to leave Western Sahara, yeah, you've seen worse than a car park in Ibiza.
Absolutely. Sam, listen, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. That's Sam Jones from The Guardian. You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Coming up, it was high stakes for Ursula von der Leyen this week, but in the end, she made it over the line with ease. After the break, Jack Power of The Irish Times looks ahead to her second term and what it all might mean for Ireland. You welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, for our final item today, we're going to turn to Europe. Take a listen to this.
I will never let the extreme polarization of our societies become accepted. I will never accept that demagogues and extremists destroy our European way of life. And I stand here today ready to lead the fight with all the democratic forces in this House.
That was, of course, Ursula von der Leyen speaking after her election as second term European Commission President after securing the backing of a majority of MPs in a crunch vote. However, 10 of the 14 Irish MEPs voted against her. For more on this now, I'm joined by Jack Power from The Irish Times. Jack, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hey, Mandy, how are you?
Now, just before we go on to what happened this week and her election, it's worth, I think, reminding everyone what happened the last time, because the margin of victory the last time was a lot slimmer than it was this week. And also this week, she got a lot more support than a lot of people expected. Take us through the numbers.
Yeah, so people will be familiar with Ursula von der Leyen. You know, she's been the European Commission President over the last 5 years. That's kind of a role where the Commission is effectively kind of the executive arm of kind of the EU, which proposes legislation and drives policy. So last time around in 2019, she scraped by the parliament vote by a margin of 9 votes. She was kind of floated in nearly from nowhere as this relatively unknown German defence minister. And she was picked by the 27 leaders, particularly French President Emmanuel Macron kind of backed her. And so the last time, she was kind of a surprise candidate. She got over the line, as I said, by a very, very thin margin against a lot of opposition in the parliament. And so this time around, it was a much different story. Mm. Obviously, she's been in, you know, power in the position for 5 years. She's, you know, made some allies, made some enemies, but she had a much more comfortable majority, even than people would have expected. She got by about a headspace of about 40 votes. So she needed 361 and she got 401.
Mm.
So a much bigger margin than people had thought. People thought it would nearly be as close as the last time in recent weeks. And then as it got closer to the vote, you know, the sense, you know, I was picking up on the ground in Strasbourg where the vote was taking place and a lot of other people were picking up, was that they were quite comfortable the closer it got that they had the numbers.
Mm. And look, she has had an awful lot to deal with during her tenure as president. She's had the pandemic, the war on the margins of Europe, the energy crisis that flowed from that, the cost of living crisis, the supply crisis issue. But possibly the most controversial thing is the stance that she's taken in relation to the Israel-Palestine war.
Yeah, so this was particularly in the Irish context, as you say, the most controversial, maybe misstep of von der Leyen's 5 years, where in the days after the October 7th attacks by the Hamas militants in southern Israel, von der Leyen travelled to Israel. You know, she saw some of the fallout of those terrorist attacks. And she effectively, in her comments, was seen as lending unconditional support to Israel and how it responded in Gaza. And we obviously saw then in the ensuing, you know, bombardment and ground invasion of Gaza and later of Rafah that, you know, led to untold kind of devastation on the Palestinian people there. And so that really galvanized opposition to von der Leyen in a really, really kind of intense way in the Irish context and others. But I think that's probably what she'll be most remembered by over the last 5 years, is that that misstep on Gaza. And she kind of became, I suppose, a symbol then of the EU's inability to agree a common position on the Middle East. You know, it took the European leaders months to come to an agreement to call for things like a ceasefire and maybe come more into line with the Irish position. So she was kind of became the figurehead almost of the EU's early failings on Gaza.
What do you think of the fact that she was the only candidate? Like, I mean, you heard people talking this week that if she didn't get through, it was going to be a disaster, a catastrophe for the European project. Did nobody want to put themselves against her, or what was that about?
Well, I suppose that was kind of a bit of politics from, you know, von der Leyen's backers to say it's her
or
total
no one.
Chaos,
yeah.
which it was an exaggeration. I mean, late last month, the 27 leaders of the national governments agreed to put von der Leyen forward for a second term, and then at that point, then she basically had to get the confirmation of a majority in the European Parliament to secure that. And no other names emerged. I think the politics of it was, you know, von der Leyen was the kind of the stability candidate, and we'll put her forward. Nobody else threw any other names into the hat at that point, but probably a few were kind of kept in the back pocket to see that, you know, if she falls and fails to get over the line at the Parliament, then you'd imagine people would have at that point suggested alternatives. But she kind of, as a result of, you know, being the incumbent, she kind of got the first crack at getting over the line herself.
Yeah. And look, she's obviously done her political job very well, because she secured a lot more votes than people thought she would. And you were writing during the week that the real story here was about the Greens coming to her aid. So they supported her as a group. Why did they do that? And what does that mean?
So the Greens made a calculation that, you know, they'd be able to back in von der Leyen and kind of being seen as maybe coming to the rescue a little bit, that they'd be able to buy influence in the next commission and kind of commitments that, you know, she wouldn't backtrack on big environmental policies and reforms, that she'd stand up for the rule of law and kind of stand up a bit to people like Viktor Orban in Hungary, who's become, you know, very right-wing and populist. And so, you know, it remains to be seen how that gamble will play out for the Greens, because they 5 years ago, they opposed her. You know, and they were very much, you know, kind of voting against a lot of her policies in the last term. So, I mean, it remains to be seen how well this kind of marriage of convenience will work. One of the Green leaders who I was chatting to said, you know, that they're effectively taking a leap of faith on von der Leyen. They're getting her over the line this time, and with the intention that they'll have some sway over her, that she won't be able to unwind a lot of the, you know, very progressive climate legislation that she passed in the first term, but in the last year has run into a fair bit of opposition from groups on her centre-right, particularly in her own party.
Yeah.
Who have been trying to pick apart some of the commitments and some of the binding elements of that climate legislation.
You did get a sense toward the end of her last term that the Green Deal commitment is sort of waning a little bit. So this will put new emphasis, at least on that, from a Green perspective. I mean, look, without them, she possibly wouldn't have made it over the line. What about the other thing that she was trying to do, which was try to keep the Greens on side? She was also courting the hard right in Italy with the Brothers of Italy. What happened there?
Yeah, so von der Leyen has had, you know, quite a good working relationship with Giorgia Meloni, the Italian Prime Minister, who her party, the Brothers of Italy, have about 24 seats in the European Parliament. So, I mean, they were a sizable enough constituency. When you're talking about when it looked like this vote might have been decided on, you know, a handful. So von der Leyen had to cut this very kind of tight balance between saying enough to the Greens to keep them happy, and then trying to give enough of a nod to Meloni's crowd as well. You know, her speech on Thursday morning went through a lot of kind of plans to try and tackle migration, which is a big issue for the Italian hard right. It promised a commissioner for the Mediterranean, which is obviously, you know, the main crossing point for migrants and asylum seekers and other people coming from North Africa to Europe. Things like tripling the amount of Coast Guard Border Patrol staff. So, I mean, that was very clearly an overture to the hard right in Italy to try and get them on side. And now it seemed that that didn't work in the end. You know, people thought at one point Meloni might play this kind of kingmaker role mm-hmm. in the new parliament. In the end, her MEPs came out and said they decided not to vote for von der Leyen. And you'd imagine then that that would limit the influence that Meloni herself was hoping to kind of hold over von der Leyen. You know, if she had also been similar to the Greens, able to say, well, look, when it mattered, I delivered the votes that were crucial for you, you know, to...
Yeah, and what was their rationale for holding back their support, the Italian MEPs?
They basically said that, you know, von der Leyen had chosen the left and the Greens and had kind of moved over in that direction. And that's what alienated them. And they said that, I suppose that was kind of going against the trend of the European elections, which saw the hard right and the far right,
right.
gain a lot of ground in other countries.
Right.
I suppose for von der Leyen, she was still able to say enough to get the Greens on side, that it meant she didn't need the Brothers of Italy party. But it was, you know, very interesting in sitting there listening to her speech, where she was trying to, you know, simultaneously yeah. court, you know, parties on, you know, very disparate ends of the spectrum of the left, all the way over to the far right.
Yeah, it was a Herculean effort in trying to catch everybody at the same time. Let's talk about Ireland. And you mentioned there that 10 out of the 14 Irish MEPs voted against her. I mean, obviously, they've all been very vocal in their stance and why they've done that. The real question now is that going to have a bearing on what our next commissioner, Michael McGrath, gets when he goes there? What is the feeling about that now that she has been elected?
I think the talk around the parliament all this week was that it would be a big factor. You know, Fianna Fáil have tried to play it down and the government have tried to play it down. But undoubtedly, it will matter when it comes to the next phase now of divvying up who's getting what commissioner jobs, you know, commissioner for, you know, the economy, the budget, trade, all these different things, that Ireland is looking for a finance-related job.
Mm.
Obviously, Michael McGrath, a former finance minister. I think that lobbying effort will be significantly harder as a result of, you know, the Irish MEPs not voting with von der Leyen. I mean, there was the four Fianna Fáilers who were in the Renew group. You had Michael McNamara and Kieran Mullooly, who were also in that Renew group. And then also Labour's Eoghan Reardon was in the Socialists and Democrats. And those two parties, Renew, or those two groupings, Renew and the Socialists and Democrats, are part of this European kind of governing majority that was backing von der Leyen. So they went against the grain in their groups. You know, in some cases, they were the main going against the rest of the parties that make up them. And so I think von der Leyen will remember that when she's coming to allocate who gets what job. You know, loyalty seems is a premium for her.
Mm.
So, you know, that will play a factor. And then also, which I think will potentially be as big an issue, is that she was speaking in a press conference after the result. And she said she would, you know, now be sending letters out basically to all the national governments, asking them to formally nominate who they want to put forward as their commissioner. And she'll be saying that she wants two names, a man and a woman. And Ireland have said that they're not going to accede to that request. They're nominating Michael McGrath, and, you know, they're pretty clear that there's not going to be a second name in their response, a female nominee.
The last time, Jack, that happened, I remember a big controversy out of that issue, and certain people were expected to put their name forward, and when there were two names being put forward, they wouldn't put their name in the hat. Were any other member states like us now that said, no, we're just putting one name forward and that's just it?
Yeah, it seems there's one or two others. In some cases, member states are putting forward an incumbent commissioner, you know, somebody who's done it for the previous 5 years, or in some cases, even who's done it and it'll be their third or fourth stint. And she said in those instances, she'll accept just the one name where it's somebody going again, basically, but where it's a new nominee, she's been clear that she wants two names. And I think this will set up a bit of a collision course between the Irish government and von der Leyen. So there's a few things working against us in getting, you know, in getting, as the government would see it, a good finance-related portfolio. And something else that I think will also come into consideration and work against us is that Michael McGrath, how it works over in Brussels is everything is kind of seen to the lens of these groupings of the European People's Party, Renew, Socialists and Democrats. Like, so much of what's decided is divvied up between the three of them, or the Greens as well. And so that matters in terms of where you sit. You know, Simon Harris is from the EPP side of it, so they'd have a bit of sway there in the same political family as von der Leyen. But Michael McGrath comes from Renew, the centrist group that you know, French President Emmanuel Macron's party sit in. And they had a bad election in June, you know, particularly in France. They lost a lot of seats. They kind of limped in, the group overall kind of limped back into Parliament, a much diminished force. And that'll have knock-on effects for when it comes to who's getting what job. That if you're a Renew commissioner, you know, you won't have as much sway as an EPP commissioner, you know, nominee effectively. Those three things are kind of all coming together in a confluence against Ireland. And, you know, what I've heard, the chatter is, you know, we'd be lucky to get a kind of a mid-table-esque portfolio, and we might even end up with a kind of a lower-end portfolio.
Well, look, there's obviously going to be a lot of politicking and manoeuvring behind the scenes, Jack, but thank you very much for joining us today to take us through all of that. That was Jack Power at the Irish Times. Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. While we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. Next week, we'll be looking at defence spending in Ireland and if we should be increasing it. For now, though, thanks to all of today's guests, the producer was John Fardy, Steve Daunt and Simon Keane were on research. Kiva Heaney was also on research. And Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on today's items, do email us on takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.